Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. This is Marion LaVance with Emily Andelman interviewing Bernard Goldberg at his home, June 18, 1986. Would you be able to tell us your address?
My address is 6310 Darlington Road.
We were interested in the socialist activities that your father participated in Russia.
Well, so far as I know from what he told me, when he was young, he was sent to, even though he was lost his father when he was, I think my dad was 9, he was sent to Cheder, and then on to your, I guess he was beginning to go to yeshiva. In any case, when the repressions of the Tsar began to be felt in Warsaw, there was a big split, you know, a great deal of debate, and a big split between the strict religionists who wanted to be more cooperative, or at least not to be revolutionary, and the ones who joined the Socialist Bund, and they became militant. So my father, being young and hot-headed, joined the Bund, and I don't know exactly what he did, except a few fights, and especially the terrible things that the Cossacks did to the Jewish population. But he didn't go into detail of not what activities, what meetings he went to.
And he didn't continue this when he came to this country.
Once he left New York, I think not, although he belonged originally to, I guess, to Arbeiter Ring. I don't know.
Well, and could you tell us again the name of the small town near Warsaw that your family lived?
I think it's called Praha. It's just across the river.
Do you have any idea how it's spelled?
So far as I know, in English, it's usually spelled P-R-A-H-A.
And tell us, we couldn't quite understand, who had the dairy store?
My father's grandfather and whole family, whose name, of course, was Goldberg.
Mm-hmm. And also from last time, when was it that your parents, when did they die?
My father died in 1969, and my mother passed away in 1982.
And did they live here that time, for the whole time? Did they live with you, or did they live in Illinois?
No, they lived in Illinois, and then they moved to St. Louis. Let me see, in about, I have to figure. '45 or '46, something like that.
All right, and also from last time, we wondered about the sequence, the birth sequence of your siblings. You mentioned there, you were speaking about them, but we didn't quite understand the ages.
Yes. My older brother was 10 years older than I. My next brother, who's still living, is 5 years older than I. And my sister was 9.5 years younger than I.
Oh.
So there's about 20 years difference between my older brother and my sister.
All right. And also we were interested in the music lessons that you had in Paris. What was the name of your teacher there?
My teacher was the principal flute of the Paris Opera. His name was Lucien, L-U-C-I-E-N, Lavaillotte, L-A-V-A-I-L-L-O-T-T-E. I went to study with the famous flutist and teacher, Marcel Moïse, M-O-Y-S-E, but he had left France and had gone to Argentina. After less than a year in Argentina, he moved to the United States and settled in the Green Mountains of Vermont. where he lived until his death, although he returned to France every year to his native village in eastern France. But he was the man I originally went to study with, and I studied in Paris with one of his earliest pupils, and then went to the big master himself.
Mm-hmm. And what was life like in Paris at that time?
When I first arrived in 1949, there were still many shortages of food and various things. I used to walk by the dairy store and by 3 o'clock sign no more milk, things like that. Of course, my cousins were full of stories about the missing members of the family. I had been accepted by the teacher in Paris in 1946 when I left the Cleveland Orchestra, but the Paris Conservatory the Paris Conservatory on my teacher's recommendation accepted me, but the French government wouldn't give me a visa because they said at that time there wasn't enough food. And when I arrived in Paris and explained this to my cousins, they said they were right, you would have been very uncomfortable, because there wasn't, at that time, right after the war, many things available, which they assumed an American couldn't do without.
did not remember the Russian immigrant family that you lived with in New York. What was their name?
Miller.
Oh, Miller.
Mm-hmm.
What was the culture, role, and political life like in St. Louis?
Well, I have no idea because I didn't grow up
you
in St. Louis, and I've only gone back there as a visitor.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I can't say. In Belleville, Illinois, which was largely, it's downstate Illinois, and very Republican, and very largely settled by South German Catholics, there was a great deal of overt anti-Semitism. And then there was a lot not quite so noticeable, but from people whom my father called the nasty nice, the pillars of society, who were still pretty anti-Semitic. For example, the swimming pool in the nice neighborhood and the newest when I was in high school and where all the middle class young people went had a sign in front saying no Jews or dogs allowed. That is the kind of thing most people don't believe happened in the United States, but it certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
When Scott Air Base enlarged so much at the beginning of the Second World War, which is, Scott Air Base is very near
mm-hmm.
Belleville, Illinois, one of the officers there found out about that and sent in a platoon of black soldiers. So the place closed and became a private club. I remember the high school principal saying to the assembly of high school students after I'd played a solo, "Thank you for applauding. After all, he's just the same as we are." This was an educated man.
What about the students themselves? Did they display anti-Semitism?
Yes, they certainly did.
Yes.
When I was young, you know, they just heard things at home.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call me Sheeny and Kike, and especially when my father opened a junkyard, you know, then I was typical. And I heard my my little buddy, who was a Protestant, talk about the youngsters from the Catholic school, which was only 3 blocks from my house, as cat lickers. And I said that once at home, and my mother promptly gave me a whop across the face, said, "Don't you ever speak about anybody in a derogatory manner like that. If you speak about Catholics like that, what would people say about the Jews?" I guess that's all disappeared then.
All right, and then when you first came to Pittsburgh, how was the symphony different, either in time schedule, or how was it set up differently than it is today?
Yes, first of all, the symphony was funded differently than it is today, because there was no stable endowment fund, and the symphony had to live from year to year on the various fund drives and ticket sales, including the tours, which were sold, you know, after all the prices for the tours were guaranteed, the contract signed with managers in New York. During the tours, evidently, the symphony lost less per week than during the concerts here. The concerts that we gave going from high school to high school were funded, I think, by the Buell Foundation. That didn't last awfully long, and eventually some of the cost was picked up by the United States government. But mostly we were dependent upon the goodwill and responsibility of the very wealthy. In those days, there was much less concentration of wealth in the foundations, so that personal favor had to be curried, and that was one job at which Dr. Reiner was not very good. I must say that although Steinberg was never a toady, he was aware of that part of his job, you know, of his responsibility after working hard, rehearsing all week and conducting a long and difficult program on his feet. He knew that in order to help the symphony survive, he had to go to the parties afterwards and be charming, and of course he had no problem with being charming, because he was an extraordinarily intelligent, of course, and enormously cultivated man. You know, he used to make jokes in 5 languages.
Can you think of any other differences? What about the audiences? Did you have as many people coming then as now?
Oh, I think that we have many more people coming to the symphony concerts now. After all, in those days, they used to say that in Pittsburgh you either owned a mill or worked in one. And neither group, frankly, was very cultured. So that, you know, you would come out of the Syria Mosque after a symphony concert and see the high and mighty among the community falling down drunk outside the Pennsylvania Athletic Club, in which we were not welcome, as you know. And I think the growth of the middle class and the educated university people, scientific people, has contributed enormously to the growth of audiences for every kind of cultural thing. I don't think that the Pittsburgh Symphony and what they call that foundation that bought the Stanley and is remodeling it, the Stanley Movie House, you know, and the Fulton Theater would be investing that kind of money if there weren't the possibilities of audience.
Mm-hmm. Do you like Heinz Hall better than you did Syria Mosque?
Oh my goodness, yes. First of all, Syria Mosque is a very funny shape for a concert hall. It's not built for a concert hall, it's built for meetings. I can't say that Heinz Hall was built for as a concert hall either, but you know, reviving the old theater and making the stunning interior decoration of the old movie house even more beautiful. It's a gorgeous place, you know, to come in, and then people look with such awe at the wonderful chandeliers and the gilt and everything. We have GILT. We have dressing rooms, which we never had at Surrey Mosque. It's not built that way. And a lounge room for the musicians. The rehearsal halls. There's no comparison. It's for me, it's a pleasure to be there. I can't say that it's the most ideal stage in the world for acoustics, but once the it's made into a single-purpose hall that is will serve only the Pittsburgh Symphony, there will be possible to do some things to the stage and to the acoustics. But now, you know, it's used for the ballet and the CLO and the opera, Pittsburgh Opera Company. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about the different conductors now? The difference that they had maybe in their philosophy and their attitude toward the music, interpretations?
Well, let me see, the differences in the conductors. I think that Fritz Reiner was very objective in his readings of the scores to try to do what he saw that the composer had written down. His watchwords that he taught us were precision, clarity, and vitality. So we had to, of course, be completely prepared before we came to the first rehearsal to know all the notes in each of our parts, because he knew all the notes in the entire score. He really studied and worked hard and always came completely prepared. He knew what he wanted before, so that he got a great deal done in a short time, and he was a magnificent baton technician. Sometimes he did things with the baton that were so beautiful in themselves, it was not worth playing, but just to sit and watch him. Some among the other great conductors we've had here, of course, Leopold Stokowski might in some way be considered the opposite, that he felt it was his duty to recreate according to his notions what each composer wanted and to communicate that to the audience. And he had a phenomenal sense of sound and sound combinations. In his own way, he was also a great technician in that his hands and face could communicate what he wanted with the musicians, and he got it done again in a minimum of time because he pushed very hard. Victor de Sabata was more perhaps in that manner. Sometimes when I hear old recordings of de Sabata, I wondered if he'd gotten some special message from some of the old long-dead composers to twist the phrases around this way and that way. But they were always convincing at the time, and the man was incredibly knowledgeable and I would say a creative genius. Some of his recordings, of course, are the classics in the world of recording. For example, the Opera Norma with Maria Callas. But he was really, truly great, and I was too young and too unknowledgeable, I was too young and too ignorant, that's more blunt, to really understand Victor de Sabata, but I still think with a great deal of gratitude about what I did learn and try to make use of that which I did understand. Paul Paré was, of course, a master in the French literature in particular, because I thought he'd been a friend of so many of the French composers of a certain period. Paré had been an organist in the church in Normandy when he was only 9 years old. When he became a conductor of the opera in Monte Carlo and was the conductor of the Cologne Orchestra in Paris, when the Nazis occupied Paris, he took as many of the Jewish musicians as he could to Monte Carlo with him. Paré's wife is Jewish. And then when the occupation, actually I guess that was Vichy, I can't remember whether he told me it was Vichy government or whether that was the Nazis, after all, Monaco is semi-independent. He would take the Jewish musicians and hide them behind the fake walls in the wine cellars of the opera house, which is part of a casino. So he was a very extraordinary man, and of course an extraordinary musician. And then there was Sir Thomas Beecham, who was so brilliant. And Steinberg, I would think, was struck the happy medium between the purely objective and the more subjective, or what they call creative kind of conducting. He was a pupil, not a pupil, of a protege of Toscanini, and had been conducting in the opera house since he was 17, where he was an assistant to Otto Klemperer, and a great musical mind, very, very hard working man. In the early days, when the steel mills were working, the Steelworkers Union sponsored a series of concerts which we did in the mill towns around, you know, to try to bring culture to the steel workers and to fulfill their responsibility more in the style of the European trade unions, political education and some cultural education. So once, I think it was in Aliquippa, we were playing in the old high school there, and during intermission I went to the men's room, and a little old fella standing next to me, "What's your name?" "Goldberg." "Aye." "You're Jewish?" "Yes." "You read Yiddish?" "Yes." "Steinberg is a Yid?" "Yes." "Why doesn't he use music?" "He doesn't need to, blah, blah, blah." "And on, is he good?" "Oh, he's wonderful, he's famous." Is he really good?" "Yes, he's well known. He had a great reputation in Germany, and he had a reputation, he's one of the founders of the Israel Philharmonic," and on, I told him. "He's really wonderful." And as we were leaving, the little old man said to me, "Nu, wusstet er beim Tug? What's his daytime job?" So I told this to the associate conductor, Carl Fritz, and he broke up laughing, and he said, "You have to tell this to Mrs. Steinberg. That man is at the piano at 6:30 in the morning for a 10 o'clock rehearsal. She practically has to make an appointment with him to find out what he wants for breakfast." Busted a banto. But a very brilliant man. And, you know, he limited the repertory that he did in Pittsburgh because I guess he had, you know, the German Jews' notion of everybody else being slightly beneath him. He never showed it, but sometimes the kind of, not like George Zell, you know, who considered himself flattered when Dorothy Thompson said, "George, if you weren't Jewish, you would make a great Prussian officer." But no, Steinberg was not like that, but still here and there. And it was an old family. He said, "Look, my family has lived in Cologne for 500 years. We had to leave. that he seemed to generally strike the balance between the objective and the subjective manner of interpretation. As far as conducting, when he first came, he was also a truly great baton technician, just dazzling. But little by little, he changed, not that his conducting deteriorated, but rather he felt it was giving more responsibility to the musicians. He wanted us to be musical collaborators, not automatons. Those are just, really, those are his words. So that it was a relationship with more Menschlichkeit than one finds with many conductors and musicians, you know. I think that they're just tools. And then Mr. Previn, of course, is incredible. Talent, very bright man, but certainly not as experienced as those people who've grown up in the opera house in Europe. Previn grew up in the movie studios in Hollywood and playing jazz piano in lounges. So he has to catch up. But he's a very, very bright and a very gentle, very nice man. I never got the feeling of, you know, the emanations of Yiddishkeit from him that I did from many of the other conductors, certainly Bernstein, you know, is the talent and showman and all that stuff. He invited me, when he came to guest conduct the Pittsburgh Symphony for a long tour the year after Fritz Reiner left, and he was the director of the Palestine. Well, I guess it was Israel Philharmonic by then. He invited me to be first flute there. And I really mulled it over a long time, and then finally I said, say, you know that if I were to take that job, I would put somebody out of work who needs that position to play. He's probably lost his job in Europe or whatever. Oh, no, he said, we'll just add another flute player. I said, listen, what good is another flute player? If I were an engineer or something that I could really help build the country, I would consider it. But this way, a flute player. He said, oh, you don't know the Israelis. They'd rather have a good flute player than an engineer. But then I said I was not ready to go live there, to give up the United States. And I said, just to go there for 2 years in order to get publicity, I can't do. So he didn't speak to me for 30 years.
That was Bernstein.
Yeah. And then, what was it? Last year, 2 years ago, I played his flute solo with orchestra called Halil, which is about a young boy whose hobby was playing flute and who was killed in the war on the Suez. The boy's parents asked Bernstein to write a piece, you know, on the commission, and he said, I don't take commissions. And then just a few years ago, he said a tune came to him. He said, this is really would sound nice on the flute, and sat down and I wrote the piece. And I did the first Pittsburgh performance with Michael Lancaster.
Well, were there many other composers whose pieces you did as the first playing?
Yes. Wilfred Meller is an English composer, musicologist, writer, authority on Elizabethan poetry and so on and so on. Was teaching at the University of Pittsburgh and he liked my playing. We became friends. His wife is a singer and he wrote a piece for me and the Pittsburgh Symphony, which of course the world premiere was here, and he revised it and I did it at the Edinburgh Festival in 1964. I did the first American performance of the Virgil Thomson flute concerto with the composer conducting. I did the first American performance of the concerto called a ballade by Frank Martin, Swiss composer. Recently with Mr. Previn, I did the first American performance of the concerto for flute by John Williams. People thought they were going to hear some Star Wars pieces. It was not at all Star Wars piece. I have to look in my in my PR releases to remember
isn't
which.
I've done
quite a lot, but nothing in the extremely radical kind of music making, because I don't know how to.